Hello, my name is Chrissy Champagne. You are listening to Residue, a true crime podcast dedicated to keeping you paranoid. If you are an avid true crime podcast listener, you know that the number one way that a woman usually kills someone is with poison. Jealousy, cheating, wanting that money from a life insurance policy, or even a way to get out of a relationship. Poison has remained an effective weapon for women throughout history. Today, we're going to be talking about the case of Stacy Castor. You might know her as the Black Widow of Central New York, but I thought Black Widows only killed their husbands.
You know, in my 34 years in the criminal justice system as a lawyer and as a judge, I've seen serial killers, I've seen contract killers, I've seen murders of every variety and stripe. But I have to say, Mrs. Castor, you are in a class by yourself.
Stacy Castor was born Stacy Daniels in Clay, New York on July 24th, 1967, to her parents, Jerry Daniels and Judy Eaton. Stacy was a very inquisitive child. Her mother said that she was always asking questions. She was very stubborn and she was very headstrong. As she got older, she had dreams of becoming a paralegal or a lawyer. Stacy grew up in Weedsport and she had an older sister named Darcy. She also had a brother named Jamie. Stacy's high school yearbook revealed that she liked purple, soaps, going to the movies, spending money, and looking for MI with Dipsy. Her favorite saying was, "We're talking wicked." I'm not sure what any of that means. I get the wicked. Yeah, I know what that means. I say wicked constantly still. She was also on the yearbook staff and the prom committee, and her yearbook stated that her plans for the future were to be a lawyer and to make a million in my first year of practice. Stacy would end up meeting her future husband when she was only 17. She met Michael Wallace in 1985, and the couple became a pair pretty quickly. But the thing was that Michael Wallace was a bit older than Stacy. He was also the ex-husband of Stacy's third cousin, Nancy. Nancy and Michael had already been divorced when Stacy started dating Michael. And Nancy told Michael Benson, who wrote the book Mommy Deadliest, she said that Michael was a bad boy and he got himself into some trouble quite a bit. She said that he was in and out of jail for different things, including DWI, but drinking and driving wasn't his biggest issue. And she did tell the author of the book, Mommy Deadliest, that Michael was very abusive to her. She said physically abusive, and eventually it got so bad that she just ended the relationship and left. Although this was Nancy's experience with Michael in their relationship, she didn't want everyone to think that he was this awful monster. She did say that Michael was a really big-hearted guy and that he would do anything for anybody. And she also pointed out that he was a spectacular father. Stacy is, of course, now just head over heels in love with Michael. She had told some people that this is the man of her dreams, the love of her life. Within 5 minutes of even being around Michael, Stacy already had her wedding envisioned in her mind. She already knew what she wanted her future to look like, and it was all Michael Wallace. 3 years later, in 1988, Stacy and Michael would have their first daughter, who they named Ashley. This should have been the greatest part of their relationship, but what actually ended up happening was that soon after Stacy learned that she was pregnant with Mike's baby, they broke up. And Stacy went on to have Ashley, and that's when she said that she was in love all over again, and that Ashley became the reason for Stacy's existence. Like, she only existed to take care of this baby girl. And as Ashley grew, her and her mother would say that they were best friends. Like, absolutely the best of friends who did everything together. Soon after Ashley's birth, Stacy and Mike reconcile and they end up getting married. They would end up being married in the Daniels home. Stacy's mother, Judy Eaton, would say that this was the happiest that she had ever seen Stacy. Judy would say she was so happy with Michael, certainly happier than she'd ever been before. 3 years after Ashley was born, Stacy and Michael now welcome another little baby girl named Bree. Bree would go on to become Daddy's little girl, and Michael would refer to her as his little princess. Friends and family members would go on to say that you could see that Michael preferred Bree over Ashley. I don't know how much of that is true, but they would really, you know, push this point home. In the book, Mommy Deadliest, Michael Benson points out that it was hard to say at the time if that was actually the truth, that Michael preferred one daughter over the other. It was just something that was, you know, pointed out as the favoritism later. And was Mike's obvious favoritism towards Bree hurtful and harmful to Ashley? Ashley would later say that she does not remember it being that way at all. She said she had no intense feelings of any kind of rejection from her father, and that she remembers their life together as a happy life. As this marriage is going along, the couple has to start working odd hours, so they're not spending a lot of time together anymore, and they're on completely separate schedules. Stacy worked as an ambulance dispatcher by day, and Mike was working as a mechanic. About 10 years into the marriage between Mike and Stacy, there was a lot of trouble going on. There was infidelity on both sides, and friends were saying that things seemed to get pretty bad between the two. Friends were also always asking Stacy, you know, why not just get a divorce? And there always seemed to be an excuse coming from Stacy that, you know, it just wasn't the right time. It was a holiday coming up or a vacation was coming up, and she really didn't want to upset the children. It is around late 1999 that everyone starts to notice that Michael's health is becoming a bit of an issue. It seems like he is constantly in and out of the hospital. He's always got a sickness. Michael tells his doctor, "I don't know what the problem is, doc. I always feel drunk, even though I haven't been drinking. I'm dizzy. My equilibrium is off. One time I got up off the toilet and I could barely stand." So the doctors are trying their hardest to figure out what is going on. They're like, "Is this vertigo? Is it diabetes, an inner ear infection? Is he drinking too much?" Nobody can figure out what is going on with Michael's health. Ashley is now 12 years old, and she has also noticed that her father is not the same man. He doesn't act the same. He's constantly tired. In fact, one day she comes home from school and her father is laying on the couch, and she recalls that he just looked like he was positioned strange. She said that it looked to me like he was making funny faces. She remembers that she was frightened. She saw her father there on the couch, and that she said he lifted one arm up into the air and then it just dropped to his side. Ashley is frightened by what she sees, but she also has the responsibility of picking her younger sister Bree up from school, so she must leave to go get Bree. She doesn't think anything of it because, well, first of all, she's 12 years old. And second of all, her father has been acting like this for weeks now around the family. So she leaves to go pick Bree up from school. And when she returns home, holding Bree's hand, there is an ambulance at the house. Stacy would then come out of the home and tell the girls to go next door to the neighbor's house and wait for her. And it is here at the neighbor's house that Stacy's mother, Judy Eaton, comes over to tell the two girls that their father has passed away. Ashley would go on to feel just an enormous amount of guilt over this, thinking, was there something that I could have done? Is there someone that I should have called? But she's 12 years old. She has no idea what was happening with her father. She states in the book by Michael Benson that she would relive this moment over and over in her head. Doctors would end up ruling that Michael Wallace died of a heart attack. There would be no autopsy, considering the fact that Michael was in and out of the hospital on numerous occasions and everyone noticed that he was ill. It's odd that there was no autopsy. So heart attack is the cause of death, and that is how it's going to stand. At this point, Stacy's going to collect a $50,000 life insurance policy. Stacy ends up using some of this money to take the girls on a vacation to Disneyland. And it's at this point that the three girls are now just becoming so close and just bonded beyond belief. It's just the three of them now, and they're helping each other get through this difficult time. And as they do it, they're just becoming way tighter as a family unit. About a year has passed now, and Stacy is going to meet a man named David Castor, and she meets him through her boss at work. At this point, David was married to a woman named Janice, and they get a divorce. Janice and David also have a child together named David Jr. So David and Stacy start to date. And Stacy ends up going to work for David at his company. He owns a heating and air conditioning cooling company. David's ex-wife Janice says that David always hired the woman that he was dating to work with him. David was a pretty successful businessman. He had a very, very beautiful home. He had lots of toys, they say, like snowmobiles, four-wheelers, ATVs. Are those the same thing? Anyway, David had all that stuff, and now he wants to share it all with Stacy. So, you know, this is like Stacy's dream come true. Like, I just found this man who's going to not only give me a job, but he is wealthy, he's successful, he wants to marry me. There's only one thing that's wrong with this situation. David wanted absolutely nothing to do with Stacy's children. It is now August 2005, and David wants to share a vacation with his new wife. He wants to take Stacy on a two-week vacation to an amusement park so that they can celebrate their love. And he wanted to go on this vacation alone. He did not want the girls coming with them. David had a grown son, and he didn't want any part of now raising someone else's children. So Ashley's old enough that she can stay home by herself. I believe she was 17 at this time, but Bree was only about 14 years old, and Stacy just did not feel comfortable leaving her 14-year-old home alone for 2 weeks. Of course, David is pissed about this. He has planned this trip. What the hell? The kids are in the way. And obviously, David and Stacy are now going to have a huge fight. David gets angry and he starts drinking alone in his bedroom. And this is according to Stacy. Stacy says that is the last time she saw David until the next day when David didn't show up for work and Stacy calls 911. Here's what she says to the 911 operator the second that they answer. Stacy says, "My husband has locked himself in our bedroom for the last day and he is not answering his phone. He didn't show up for work this morning." The operator asks, how had he been acting? And Stacy tells her, Friday night we were arguing and he told me and my kids to get out. And then 5 minutes later, he said if I left, he would make me sorry. And I would be sorry if I ever left him. Police arrive on the scene almost immediately and they enter David Castor's bedroom. What they find is David lying on his bed, completely naked. There is a brown matter which appeared to be bloody vomit pulled under his head, and the vomit was also on his hands and underneath his fingernails. There was a table next to the bed that had cranberry juice, apricot brandy, and most disturbing, they found a bottle of the brand Peak antifreeze underneath the bed. Next to the cranberry juice and the apricot brandy, there was a small rocks glass, and it contained a bright neon green liquid. One of the deputies on the scene, Deputy Lawrence Knapp, he also described a mucus coming out of David's nose and mouth. He says that this type of mucus is usually a sign that poison was involved in the death. Now, these detectives are not stupid. Right away, this scene does not make any sense. A few things that are out of place for a scene like this are the fact that David had a gun underneath his bed. David was also completely naked. Most people don't take off every piece of clothing before they are about to do something so horrible as to take their own life. Another thing that police were looking at is the thing that we all know. Most men don't use poison to kill themselves. That's usually what they refer to as a female thing, which is ridiculous, but that's the way that it's looked at. So the police are already like, no. Now they are in the kitchen of the Castor home and they are searching through everything just to get a sense of what happened. And one of the officers finds a turkey baster in the trash. And he states that this turkey baster looks almost brand new, so why is it in the trash? As he's looking closer at the baster, he notices that there are green droplets on it. And he smells the droplets and they kind of smell like alcohol, maybe? Antifreeze, maybe? He can't tell. I read this article on Healthline.com and I just want to read to you exactly what antifreeze is and exactly what it does to a person if they ingest it. The article states, antifreeze is a liquid that prevents the radiator in cars from freezing or overheating. It's also known as engine coolant. Although water-based, antifreeze also contains liquid alcohols like ethylene glycol, propylene glycol, and methanol. Propylene glycol is an ingredient in some foods and cosmetics. It isn't harmful in considerable small amounts, according to the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry. On the other hand, ethylene glycol and methanol are hazardous and poisonous if ingested, and it only takes a small amount of antifreeze to poison the human body and cause life-threatening complications. Antifreeze poisoning can happen gradually over several hours, so you may not have symptoms immediately after ingesting the chemical. Your body will slowly begin to react to the antifreeze that's in your system. The time it takes for the first symptoms to appear varies, and it depends on the amount that you have swallowed. The earliest symptoms can develop 30 minutes to 12 hours after ingesting the antifreeze. The more severe symptoms are going to start about 12 hours after ingesting. Early symptoms of the poisoning may include an inebriated feeling. Other symptoms are going to include headache, fatigue, lack of coordination, grogginess, slurred speech, nausea, and vomiting. And as your body continues to break down the antifreeze over the next several hours, the chemical can interfere with your kidney, lung, brain, and nervous system function. Organ damage can occur 24 to 72 hours after you have ingested the antifreeze. So, along with everything else in the home that the police found, they also found Stacy's fingerprints on the bottom of that one little rocks glass full of a neon green liquid, and they found her fingerprints on the turkey baster. Detective Valerie Brogan and Detective Dominic Spinelli go to Stacy's home to interview her. And I wish that I had audio of this interview to play for you, because here's how it goes down. As the two detectives are talking to Stacy, they're asking her a bunch of questions, and then they ask her to tell them what glass she poured the cranberry juice into. And this is when Stacy says, "When I was pouring the cranberry juice." She really said that. She really said, "When I was pouring the antifree." And then she stopped herself and said, "I mean cranberry juice." You know, they got her now. They got her. And Stacy then says, "You know what? I want a lawyer. I don't want to talk to you anymore. I am going to get a lawyer first." And the cops are like, "Okay, cool." As she's getting up and the two detectives decide to pack their stuff away, their folders away, Stacy notices that Detective Spinelli has a picture of her turkey baster in one of his folders. And Stacy says, "Why do you have that? Why do you have a picture of my turkey baster?" And Detective Spinelli is like, "That's none of your business. You asked for a lawyer. This interview is done." Apparently, Stacy is not able to handle this pressure. She is nervous, and it shows. The police have now wiretapped all of Stacy's phones, and they also put cameras at her house. And you know where else they put cameras? They put them at the cemetery. The cemetery where Michael Wallace and David Castor were buried, directly next to each other. In September 2007, the police were able to get Michael Wallace's body exhumed. They needed to give this body an autopsy, because here's the thing. When you have had antifreeze in your system, when you have ingested it, what happens is that your organs are going to now be loaded with these little crystals. And these little crystals from antifreeze never go away. So they exhume Michael Wallace's body, and it is loaded. I'm talking loaded with crystals. Stacy goes to the cemetery because she heard news that they were possibly exhuming Michael's body. So she goes to the cemetery and cameras catch her. She sees that the grave is empty. And what does she do? She starts to lose her damn mind, is what is happening. She knows. She knows if they took Michael out of that grave that they're going to catch her. It's at this point, as Stacy's freaking out, losing her mind, she gets a phone call from her daughter, Ashley. Ashley is frantic on this phone call. She is just crying, yelling, "Mommy, they came to my freaking school." And this is because the police officers showed up at Ashley's first day of college, and they inform her that her father, Michael Wallace, has in fact died of antifreeze poisoning. Stacy tells Ashley to just hurry home, you know, get home. We've had a rough week. Let's just get drunk. This is completely shocking to Ashley because her mom never said stuff like that. Ashley's never been drunk. She's never been drunk with her mother. She's 20 years old. And you know what? It's been a really hard day. And she thinks, you know what? This is awesome. My mom's my best friend. Yeah, I'm gonna have a drink with my mom right now. Maybe that's exactly what I need. Ashley arrives home. Stacy is making some drinks for the two of them. She's got vodka. She's got orange juice. She's asking Ashley if she's ever had a screwdriver, and Ashley has not. So perfect. Stacy's mixing it up. Ashley's drinking it. It's about a 12-ounce glass. Ashley says that she starts to drink this screwdriver, and she can also see like little little white things floating in it, little tiny pieces of something white. But she's never had a drink before. This is just normal, I guess. She asks her mother, like, is it supposed to taste this way? And Stacy tells her, it's supposed to taste that way. And the best way to do it is maybe shove the straw into the back of your throat and just drink. Just keep drinking. Ashley does it because she trusts her mother. And she starts to feel really sleepy, really lethargic. And so she goes to bed. She wakes up the next morning and she just feels like an absolute nightmare. She can't believe what this feels like. She chalks it up as, you know what? This is probably what a hangover is. But Ashley, because she's so badass, still wakes up and goes straight to school. She's not missing those classes again. Ashley makes it through the day. She gets home from school. It's a little before noon, and Stacy wants to get drunk again. Ashley is saying to her mother, it's not even noon, and I feel like hell. Stacy tells her, well, it'll be noon by the time we start drinking. So they start to have some more drinks. Ashley would end up waking up that next morning in the intensive care unit, not having any idea what had happened the night before. Ashley wakes up to blurry faces. She says that she can't see anyone's faces, and there's a detective standing next to her, and he's yelling at her, and he's asking her what she did. She has no idea what is going on. She has no idea what anyone is talking about. She says to the detective, I don't know what you're talking about. I was just having a drink with my mother. She says, the drink didn't taste good and my mother gave me a straw. This is all that I remember. Let's backtrack to what happened before Ashley arrived to the hospital. So Ashley's drinking with her mother. She starts to get sleepy again. She falls asleep. And the next morning, her sister Bree wakes up to see Ashley unresponsive on her bed. Ashley's eyes are wide open, and Bree starts screaming for her mother to come help. She said that she was screaming, Mommy, Mommy, come help. Something's wrong with Ashley. Stacy says that everyone was crazy with panic, and so Stacy calls 911 and begins to tell them that her daughter Ashley drank vodka and pills. Stacy can be heard on the 911 call saying, I need an ambulance. My daughter has taken some pills. Stacy also keeps telling the 911 operator that her daughter left a letter. She says it over and over. She left a letter. This was a typed 750-word letter that read the words, I killed my dad, I killed my stepdad. Ashley lays dying in the intensive care unit with a heart rate of 170 to 190 times a minute. Her vitals are plummeting, and the doctors say she had a cornucopia of drugs in her system. Police tell Stacy that she is not allowed to see Ashley when she arrives at the hospital. Police look over the suicide note. They are reading it for any clues. And in a lot of the lines, it's just Ashley apologizing. She calls Stacy mommy a lot. There's a quote in it, something like, now they won't blame you anymore, mommy. I'm sorry I did this. But the police are going to really luck out with this letter, because what is one thing that Stacy cannot do? Stacy cannot say the word antifreeze. Stacy calls it anti-free, F-R-E-E. And when the police had their first conversation with her, she called it antifree over and over in an interview. And they noted that in their notes because they thought that was strange, that she wasn't even pronouncing the word correctly. In this typed confession, suicide note slash confession, Stacy writes the word antifree over and over. And that cannot be a coincidence. Police know they have her, and right now they just need to focus on Stacy. They need Ashley to get better, and what do they do? Stacy is at the hospital just waiting for someone to let her in to see her daughter, so she goes outside to have a cigarette. She's outside smoking, and the detectives walk right up to her and they say, "Stacy Caster, you are under arrest." Stacy would be arrested for the murder of David Caster and the attempted murder of her own daughter, Ashley Wallace. Stacy would end up hiring defense attorney Chuck Keller, and his defense team starts hunting for reasonable doubt because they found that several letters of Ashley's that were found in her bedroom that were written to her boyfriend said that she wanted to kill herself after breaking up with her boyfriend. And that letter was crucial for the defense because when Ashley was first brought to the hospital, the detectives were kind of grilling her before they knew the situation. And they asked her, "Did you ever want to kill yourself? Were you trying to kill yourself?" And Ashley said, "I never wanted to kill myself." So the defense team seems to think that these letters that she wrote as a teenage girl to her boyfriend after he broke up with her, saying she was going to kill herself, were just like their smoking gun. Which, come on. As teenagers, we've all exaggerated how bad a breakup feels. Stacy's defense was going to be that Ashley was just incredibly jealous of her sister Bree because of her relationship with their father Michael, and that she believed that Ashley had a temper and just hated David, so that's why she killed David. To make matters worse in this entire situation, Stacy's mother, Judy, does not believe that her daughter, Stacy, could do anything wrong. She does not think that Stacy did this. She thinks that her own granddaughter did it, and she will stand behind Stacy. Can you imagine what that felt like for Ashley? Just take a second to think about the fact that this young lady has lost her father. She lost her stepfather. She's in a hospital being told by police that her mother tried to kill her and frame her for murder, like ruining her name forever. And then your grandmother doesn't even believe you. Your grandmother takes the side of the woman who has clearly been running this whole scheme. Ashley is strong as fuck. Ashley is now going to have to stand in front of her mother, her grandmother, in a court and testify to what happened to her. And thankfully, she had William Fitzpatrick, the district attorney in Onondaga County, on her side. Because let me tell you, that man was not letting Stacy get away with this. To give you an example, newscaster Christy Casciano said of D.A. Fitzpatrick, she said, "D.A. Fitzpatrick is a bulldog. Once he sticks his teeth into something, he doesn't let go." Ashley will take the stand as the first witness, and she will tell the jury about the day that her father died on that couch. She will also talk about the first round of drinking with her mother, which was considered a test run. She also said that her mother kept telling her to stir the cup. She kept telling her mother it doesn't taste good, and Stacy would come back with the drink filled up more. Ashley is asked, "Why did you drink it?" And she responds, "Because I trusted her." They then move on to the suicide note. They show Ashley the suicide note, and they ask if she's ever seen it, and she says no. During this, the mother and daughter never make eye contact, not once. It is now time for Stacy to testify in her own defense. And everyone was on the edge of their seats wondering, is Stacy Caster going to testify? Because, you know, it's not typical for someone to do that. they usually make themselves look pretty awful. Stacy testifies in her own defense, and she talks about Michael Wallace being her true love, love of her life. Stacy stays very calm, and D.A. Fitzpatrick, he speaks to her as if, yes, she is a murderer. He is screaming, yelling at her. She's not flinching. Fitzpatrick starts to focus on a wiretap that was retrieved. And in this wiretap, you can hear Stacy talking to her friend on the phone, but while she's talking to her, you can hear a keyboard clicking, like she's typing a letter. After Stacy's computer was examined by forensics, they noted that there were two practice runs of this letter written under Stacy's own account. And these letters were written at a time when Ashley would have been out at school or not in the house. Stacy still never shows any emotion during any of this. This was a 4-week trial with over 50 witnesses. And once the trial is over, it will take 4 days for the jury to come up with the conclusion that Stacy Castor is guilty. First count, murder in the second degree. Guilty for the death of David Castor. The second count, attempted murder in second degree. Guilty of attempting to kill Ashley Wallace. She would receive 51 years to life in prison. Ashley Wallace would say, "Honestly, that was the best day of my life." Ashley was given the chance to speak at her mother's sentencing. She stood there crying as her sister Bree held her.
"I hate my mother for ruining so many people's lives. I don't even know why she did it. What gave her the right to play God with people? And I hate her for having me be the one that found my dad, just like her for having Bree found me. I never knew what hate was until now. Even though I do hate her, I still love her at the same time. That bothers me. It's so confusing. How can you hate someone and love them at the same time? I just wish that she would say sorry for everything she did, including all the lies. And though I feel bad for her today as she sits there all by herself, she's the one that did this to herself and nothing bothers her. After my mom is sentenced today, I'll go back to my loving home with people who care about me. She's not gonna go home. And if she hadn't chose to do these things, she could be home with me and Bree. She would not have to worry about anything. I've cried enough tears about this, and I don't want to cry anymore. I just want it all to go away, but I know it will never go away. I have to live with this for the rest of my life. There are times when I get afraid, thinking I might turn out like her, because she was good at one time. But I know I won't. And I know I could never hurt my children like she did. I hate how she tried to make me look stupid in that note that she wrote. I've tried so hard to make something of myself. I have a 3.9 GPA and still she tried to make me look stupid. But Mr. Fitzpatrick made her look stupid with her lies. I hate how she made people choose side in our family with our friends. Bree and I are children. People are supposed to stand up for us."
In 2016, the Castor family finally succeeded in having David Castor's body moved away from Michael Wallace. David Castor Jr. and his wife picked out a new headstone for his father. Some say that this could have actually been Stacy's little playground. She had both husbands buried next to each other, and who knows if she would have had Ashley also buried there. There is another turn to this story that I want to add in real quick before I finish. Stacy Castor's father, Jerry Daniels, was also buried next to David Castor and Michael Wallace. CNY Central had an article come out on Monday, February 1st, 2010, which asked the question, did convicted murderer Stacy Castor kill her own father in addition to her two husbands? And DA Bill Fitzpatrick confirmed that his office at that time was investigating the circumstances that surrounded the death of Jerry Daniels on February 27, 2002. Jerry Daniels had been in the hospital and was actually getting better, but family members say that Stacy went to visit him one day, and when she did visit, she brought an open can of soda for her father to drink. The very next day, Jerry Daniels was pronounced dead, and Stacy Castor had her father's remains cremated. Fitzpatrick did admit that since the body was cremated, it's going to make it very difficult to also prove that Stacy had something to do with this, and he did say he is not optimistic that they were going to get proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Michael Wallace's brother-in-law, John Corbett, told reporter Jim Kenyon that this was Stacy's monument to murder. In 2020, Ashley Wallace spoke to OprahMag.com and has stated that she has moved on with her life, but she still struggles with the after effects of trauma. She credits her counselor, doctor, and loved ones with her progress. Ashley says, "I would not be as far in life as I am if I gave up and turned to drugs or alcohol." On June 11, 2016, Stacy Castor died in prison at age 48 of natural causes. Stacy Castor never spoke to or saw her daughters again. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Residue. If you did enjoy the show, it would be super sweet of you to share with your friends. And find me on Instagram at Residue Podcast. You can find me on Facebook at Residue, a true crime podcast. And if you're feeling even nicer, maybe leave me a 5-star review. But I just enjoy you coming back each week and listening. I want to remind all of you to stay safe and stay paranoid.